Usually I pretend I'm reading a water meter or checking for gas leaks. Any officious task that necessitates crawling through somebody's bushes and tampering with their security systems. Today I slapped on an FTD patch and headed for the nearest florist, where I laid out $36 for a massive bouquet. I bought a syrupy get-well card, scribbled an illegible name, and put in a quick call to the dry cleaning establishment where Bibiana worked. A woman answered this time. "Oh, hi," said I. "May I speak to the owner, please?" "This the plant. He just left on his way over to the other place," she said. "You want that number?" "Sure." She recited the number to me carefully, and I recited it back as if I were writing it down. What did she know? She couldn't see what I was doing anyway. "Thanks," I said. I hung up and hopped in my car, flowers on the seat beside me. I drove over to the plant. There was a nice green length of curb out in front, 15 minutes of free parking. I locked the car and went in. I stood at the counter briefly, waiting for service. The place smelled of soap products, damp cotton, chemicals, and steam. The area behind the counter was a forest of clothing in clear plastic bags. On my left, an elaborate electronic tram moved hanging garments in a tortuous track that snaked up and around, returning to the point of origin so that any garment on board could be delivered to the station when the proper number was punched in. To the right, a maze of overhead pipes supported garments in the process of being pressed. There were 10 women within my visual range, most of them Hispanic, working machines whose function one could only guess. A radio had been tuned to a Spanish-language station that was blasting out an up-tempo cut from a Linda Ronstadt album. Two of the women sang as they worked, moving men's shirts expertly across the machines in front of them. With the syncopated rhythm of the irons, the shirt machines, the clouds of billowing steam, the place looked like the perfect setting for a musical number. One of the two singing women finally noticed me. She left her machine and came over to the counter where I was waiting. She was short and compact, with a round face, eyes the color of chocolate M&Ms, and coarse dark hair pulled into a snood. The loose gold satin blouse she wore was sprinkled with sequins. She glanced at the bouquet. "Those for me?" I checked the attached florist's card. "Are you Bibiana Diaz?" "Nah, she's off this week." "She won't be in at all?" The woman shook her head. "She hurt her back in this accident, about 2 months ago, and it's still bothering her. The pain flares up, she says, real bad. She can't hardly walk. Boss told her, no way, don't come in. He don't want no kind of lawsuit." "She got a boyfriend?" I turned the card over, holding it up to the light. "Looks like a get-well card, actually. Shoot. Now what am I supposed to do?" "Take him to her house," she said. "I can't. This is the only address he gave." "You don't happen to have her home address, do you?" "Nah, I never been there myself," the woman said. She turned to one of the other women. "Hey, Lupe, where's Bibiana live?" The second woman shook her head, but a third piped up. "On Castano. I don't know the number, but it's this big brown house in front and her place in back. She's got this little bungalow, real cute, between Huerto and Arroyo." The woman at the counter turned back to me. "You know the block she's talking about?" "I'll find it," I said. "Thanks, you've been a big help." "I'm Graciela. Tell the guy to look me up, he gets tired of her. I got all the same equipment, just arranged different." I smiled. "I'll do that." The second address on Bibiana turned out to be a dank-looking brown cottage at the back of a dank brown house, located in a midtown neighborhood, distinctly down at the heel. I spotted the house in passing, then circled the block and parked across the street. I sat and scanned the premises. The lot was long and narrow, sheltered by the overhanging branches of magnolia, juniper, and pine trees. There was not a shred of grass anywhere, and what vegetation there was seemed in desperate need of a trim. A cracked concrete drive cut along the property to the right. In the larger house in front, someone had nailed sagging floral print bedsheets across the windows in lieu of drapes. There were no cars in the drive. According to the claim form, her 1978 Mazda was still in the body shop, having the right side panel replaced, among other things. I waited 20 minutes, but there was no visible activity. I torqued myself around, reaching into the back seat for the locked briefcase where I keep assorted false IDs, for occasions such as this. I pulled a set for Hannah Moore, neatly tucked into a plastic accordion file. California driver's license with my stats and a photo of me, social security and credit cards for Visa and Chevron gasoline. Hannah Moore even had a library card, since I wanted her to appear literate. I shoved my shoulder bag under the front seat and tucked the ID in my trouser pocket. I got out, locked my car, crossed the street, and made my way down the driveway. The tall trees on the property shaded it to an unpleasant chill, and I found myself wishing I'd brought a windbreaker or a sweatshirt. The exterior of Bibiana's vintage cottage was a shaggy brown shingle, the perfect little snack for a swarm of hungry termites. I climbed two wide creaking wooden steps to a tiny porch piled with junk. A casement window on the right side had a length of red cotton hung across the glass. I tried to peek in, but I really couldn't see much. The interior seemed quiet, and there were no lights visible. I knocked on the front door, taking advantage of the moment to survey my immediate surroundings. A metal mailbox was nailed to the siding near the front door. Seven addressed and stamped envelopes were loosely tucked in the catch rack, awaiting pickup by the mailman. So far, no one had answered my knock. The cottage had an unoccupied air, and I fancied I could already pick up the faintly musty scent generated by some dwellings with even the briefest of absences. I knocked again, waiting an interminable few minutes before concluding there was really no one home. Casually, I looked toward the big house, but there were no signs of life, no accusing faces peering out the windows at me. I reached over and let my fingers tippy-toe through the envelopes. When no alarms went off, I picked up the whole batch and sorted through them at my leisure. Four were bills. She was paying telephone, gas, electricity, and a department store. There were two number 10 envelopes, one addressed to Aetna Insurance, and one to Allstate, both with Lola Flores listed on the return address. Oh, gee, wonder what that could be, I thought. Cheaters never quit. It looked like the scam extended beyond the claim against California Fidelity. The seventh piece of mail was a personal letter addressed to someone in Los Angeles. I plucked it out of the stack, folded it, slipped it down the waistband of my trousers and into my panties. Shame on me. That's a federal crime. The stealing part, not the underpants. I returned the rest of the letters to the catch rack. Suppressing the impulse to run, I sauntered off the porch, ambled up the drive, and crossed the street to my waiting car. I opened the car door on the passenger side, tossed the clipboard on the front seat, barely missing the bouquet, and locked up again. I could see a mini-market on the corner of Huerto and Arroyo, about 10 houses down on the right. I headed in that direction in hope of finding a telephone. The market was a tiny mom-and-pop operation, the front windows papered over with hand-lettered advertisements for beer, cigarettes, and dog food. The interior was dimly lighted, and there was sawdust on the uneven wooden floor that looked like it had been there since the place was built. The shelves were a jumble of canned goods in no particular order that I could discern. Freestanding shelves formed two narrow aisles crowded with everything from Pampers to Jell-O to lawn care products. Near the front, there was a refrigerated soft drink case and an ancient crypt-style freezer filled with frozen vegetables, fruit juices, and ice cream bars. Mom was standing at the front counter in a white wraparound apron, a half-smoked cigarette in one hand. She was probably 65, with a stiffly sprayed flip of blonde hair and a wide scab mustache where she'd had the wrinkles dermabraded off her upper lip. The skin on her face had been hiked up and tacked behind her ears, and her eyes had been stitched into an expression of permanent amazement. "You have a pay telephone?" "Back by the stockroom," she said, pointing with her cigarette. A half inch of ash dropped off and tumbled down the front of her apron. I dropped four nickels into the coin slot and called Mary Bellflower, giving her Bibiana Diaz's hard-won address.
End of disc 1. Disc 2.
I dropped 4 nickels into the coin slot and called Mary Bellflower, giving her Bibiana Diaz's hard-won address. Thanks. This is great, she said. I've got a packet of forms I can ship right out. Are you coming back to the office? Yeah, I'll be there in a bit. I thought I'd hang around for a while and see if Bibiana shows. Well, stop in later and we'll figure out where we go from here. Has Gordon Titus come back? Nope, not yet. Maybe it was a rout. I doubt that, I said. When I hung up the receiver, a nickel tumbled down into the return coin slot. My lucky day. On my left there was a meat counter with a slanted glass front. A sign above it advertised the lunch special. Chili beans, coleslaw, and a tri-tip sandwich for $2.39. The smell was divine. Tri-tip is apparently a regional phenomenon, some cut of beef nobody else has ever heard of. Periodically, a local journalist will try to trace the origin of the term. The accompanying article will show a moo cow in profile with all the steaks drawn in. Tri-tip is on the near end, opposite the hiney bumper. It's usually barbecued, sliced, and served with homemade salsa on a bun or wrapped in a tortilla with a sprig of cilantro. Pop emerged from the walk-in freezer. A breath of winter wafted out. He was a big man in his 60s with a benign face and mild eyes.
What can I get you?
How about the tri-tip to go? He winked at me, smiling slightly, and prepared it without a word. Sandwich in hand, I grabbed a Diet Pepsi from the cooler and paid at the front register. I returned to my car, where I dined in style, being careful not to spill salsa down the front of my uniform. The flowers, getting limper by the minute, filled the VW's interior with the smells of a funeral home. I kept an eye on Bibiana's driveway for 2 hours, perfecting my surveillance zen. In many PI firms, surveillance work is charged off at a higher rate than any other service offered because it's such a yawn. There were no signs of activity, no visitors, no lights coming on. It occurred to me if I intended to watch the place for long, I'd better contact the beat officer and let him know what was going on. Also, it might be smart to borrow another vehicle and maybe cook up some reason to be loitering in the vicinity. The postman came by on foot and picked up the letters waiting in Bibiana's box, replacing them with a handful of mail. I would have given a lot to see who was writing to her, but I didn't want to press my luck. Where was the woman? If her back hurt so bad, how come she was out all day? Maybe she was at the chiropractor's getting all her vertebrae lined up or her head replaced. At 3, I started up the car and headed back toward town. When I arrived at the California Fidelity offices, I gave the bouquet to Darcy at the front desk. She had the good taste not to mention my little run-in with Titus. Her gaze rested briefly on my uniform. You joined the Air Force? I just like to dress like this. Those shoes look like they'd be lethal in a kickboxing contest, she remarked. If you're here for Mary, she's got some clients with her, but you can probably mosey on back. Mary had been hired as a CF claims representative in May, when Jewel Cavalletto retired. She'd been assigned the desk Vera had occupied before her promotion to the glass-enclosed office up front. Mary was smart but inexperienced, a young 24, with the kind of face just pretty enough to net her second runner-up in a regional beauty contest. I give her credit for the fact that she had flagged the Diaz claim. She had a good eye, and if she could hang in long enough, she'd be a real asset to the company. She'd been married for 3 months to a salesman for the local Nissan dealership and was taking an avid interest in Vera's wedding plans. One of Mary's own wedding invitations, gauzy pink background depicting daisies blowing in a field, had been framed in brass and propped up on her desk. Where Vera had always tucked the latest issue of Cosmopolitan magazine under the stacks of claim folders on her desk, Mary read Brides, whose influence apparently extended from the engagement through the first year of marriage. Mary had once appealed to me for my recipe for chicken divan until Vera set her straight. Now she tended to regard me with the pity of the newly married for those of us determined to stay single. I chatted with Darcy for a few minutes more, and then made my way back to Mary's workstation, pausing to say, "Hi," to a couple of other claims adjusters en route. Word of my skirmish with Titus had apparently spread, and I'd been accorded celebrity status, which I figured would last until I got fired. One day at best. Mary's clients, a man and a woman, were just leaving as I reached her cubicle. The woman was in her 30s, with a shaggy mane of bleached hair, the styling faintly punk. Her eyes were lined with harsh black, her lashes clearly false. Her patterned black hose and the trashy slingback pumps with spike heels seemed at odds with the severe cut of her business suit. She seemed far less aware of me than I was of her, barely glancing in my direction as she passed by in the narrow aisle between cubicles. Her companion followed at a leisurely pace, an attitude of arrogance displayed in the very way he walked. He had his hands in his pockets as if he had all day, but I could have sworn he was keeping a tight rein on himself. His dark hair was combed away from his face. He had thick brows above big dark eyes, high cheekbones, and a mustache cut so that it seemed to trail down around his mouth. He was well over 6 feet tall, the heft of his broad shoulders exaggerated by the padding in his plaid sport coat. He looked like the bad guy's ominous sidekick in a primetime television show. As he came abreast of me, he tried to sidestep, but bumped me in the process. He caught my arm apologetically and murmured a, "Hey, sorry," as he headed on down the corridor. I caught a whiff of the hair tonic he was using to subdue the wave in his dark pompadour. I found myself staring after them as I moved into Mary's cubicle. She wasn't at her desk, but she appeared a half second later, eyes pinned on a Dixie cup filled with water to the brim. She wore a red cashmere sweater with the sleeves pushed up. Her complexion was fresh and clear, her skin shiny with good health. Her coloring was the stuff of magazine ads. "Here we are," she said, and then she glanced up at me with some surprise. "Oh, did they leave, the pair that was here?"
"They went that-a-way. You missed them by a half a second."
She peered out into the corridor, but there was no sign of them. "Well, that's weird. She said she wasn't feeling good, so I went to get her this."
"She looked okay to me."
Mary's mouth pulled down with puzzlement, and she set the cup of water on her desk. "I wish they'd hung around. I was hoping you could talk to them."
"About what?"
She shook her head. "They're investigators from the Insurance Crime Prevention Institute."
"She was, at any rate.
He's a special agent with the California Department of Insurance." She handed me the woman's business card.
"Him? Are you sure?"
"He was hired last month. She's been showing him the ropes."
"He looked like a hood."
She laughed uncomfortably, as if she were somehow responsible for his appearance now that I'd mentioned it. "He did, didn't he? It's that tacky coat, I'm sure. I'd never let Peter out in public in a thing like that. Have a seat. Did you talk to Bibiana Diaz?" "God, now where'd I stick her file?" She sat down and began to sort through a stack of fat manila folders on her desk.
"Nope, she's still out. I may take my camera with me next time I go over there. Maybe I can snap a picture of her doing backflips on the lawn."
I passed on the information about Lola Flores and the two other insurance companies. "Bibiana has to be running a second scam as Lola Flores. There's no telling how many other claims she's filed concurrently." Mary was properly incensed. "Oh, God, I don't believe this. I'll get on it right away and let him know what's going on."
"Just make sure they start documenting any dealings they have with her. When we send the files to ICPI, they can send theirs along, too. It should make quite a splash."
I was still half distracted by the couple who'd just left. I checked the woman's business card. The ICPI logo was legitimate, looking somehow like a placemat complete with cutlery. According to the card, she was Karen Hedgepath, from an office in Los Angeles. The problem was, she didn't look like any ICPI investigator I'd ever met. Most of them are real button-down types. Ties, white shirts, dark conservative business suits. This woman looked like a rock star in civilian clothes.
I couldn't believe the regional manager would tolerate the punk hairstyle, let alone the spike-heeled shoes. "Here we go," Mary said, extracting a file from the middle of the stack. The folder was marked Diaz, a piece of scratch paper with the new address clipped to the front. She reached for an invoice stapled to the envelope it had arrived in. "I just got a whole new sheaf of bills. I guess she saw a chiropractor." "Probably a subluxation specialist," I said, using the only chiropractic term I'd ever heard. She punched some holes in the invoice and pronged it in the file. "Actually, they were here about Bibiana. That's why I wanted them to talk to you. I guess ICPI got wind she'd moved up here. She ran a couple of scams in Santa Monica last year, and they were hoping to track her down."
"Well, that's nice. Insurance scams?"
"They didn't spell it out, but it almost has to be insurance-related, don't you think?"
I considered the situation briefly, wondering why an ICPI employee would show the ropes to someone working for another agency. It's not as though the ICPI and the Department of Insurance don't cooperate, but the Insurance Crime Prevention Institute isn't a law enforcement agency. And why would investigators make the trip up here in the first place? Why not put a call through to CF instead of driving the hour and a half? It just made no sense. Unless they lied.
"Did you give them this address?" I asked, indicating the penciled note. "I didn't give them anything. That's why I was so surprised when you said they'd left. All I did was confirm we were checking on a claim here. Why?"
"They could have spotted this while you were off at the water cooler. All they had to do was rifle the stacks of files on your desk."
"Oh, come on. You don't think they'd really do that?"
"Who knows? Let's just hope they were legitimate."
She put her hand on her chest like she was about to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. "Oh, Lord, what's that supposed to mean?"
"Well, you know how it is. You can hand out a business card that says anything. I've done it myself."
Mary seemed affronted, suddenly shifting from anxiety into action mode. "Give me that," she said. She snatched the woman's business card and laid it on the desk with a snapping sound. I watched her pick up the phone and punch in the telephone number with its 213 area code.
"I'm going to kill myself if she isn't who she said she was."
She listened for a moment, and then her expression changed. She held up the receiver, which was emitting a sound like a garbage disposal grinding up a live duck.
"Maybe you dialed it wrong," I said helpfully.
"God, I can't believe I'd fall for something so obvious, but it never occurred to me to question her identity. How could I be so dumb?"
"Well, you don't have to be so hard on yourself. After years in the business, I can still be conned. It's human nature to trust, especially if you're honest to begin with. Not that I'm that honest, but you know what I mean."
"What do you think they were up to?"
"Beats me," I said. "Obviously, they knew Bibiana, and they were aware of her inclination to cheat. The real question is, how'd they get to us? There must be 100 insurance agencies in Santa Teresa. Why CF?"
"This is terrible. I'm just sick. What could they want with her?"
Mary's cheeks had turned a bright, wholesome pink. "Probably nothing pleasant, or they would have played it straight."
"What should we do?"
"I don't see what we can do until we know what's going on.
Why don't you track down the current phone number for ICPI and ask if they're investigating her?"
I held the note up. "In the meantime, I'll try to catch up with her and we'll fake it out from there."
Chapter 5. I went home and stripped off the uniform. I transferred the fake ID from the pocket of my uniform pants to my blue jeans, which I pulled on with a navy turtleneck. I slipped into gym socks and tenny bops and headed back to Bibiana's. I hoped Mary Bellflower's naivete hadn't put Ms. Diaz at risk. There were still no cars in the drive and no sign of the couple I'd seen at the CF offices. Had they already looked up the address and hightailed it over here? They had maybe 30 minutes on me, so it was always possible that they were in the cottage right now, or had been and gone. If they'd actually been quick enough to nick off her address. A few cars passed on the street, but no familiar faces peered out. For the second time that day, I left my car, locked, on the street, and moved down Bibiana's driveway. It was now 4:35, and I could see lights on in the cottage. As I approached, I caught a tantalizing whiff of onions and garlic being sautéed in olive oil. I climbed the wide wooden steps. From inside, this time, I could hear the jaunty theme of a television sitcom, probably a cable station doing reruns. I knocked on the front door, which was opened moments later by a Hispanic woman of perhaps 25. She was barefoot, dressed in a red satin teddy with a short red satin robe pulled over it and tied at the waist. She was slim, nay, petite, with flawless olive skin and big dark eyes and a heart-shaped face. She had two tortoiseshell hairpins clamped in her teeth, as if I'd caught her in the midst of redoing her hair. Dark hair trailed halfway down her back like a shawl, a few silken strands spilling across her right shoulder. As I watched, she gathered the length of it and made a complicated knot, which she secured with the two hairpins.
Yes?
My true inclination was to stand on tiptoe so I could peer over her shoulder at the space beyond. The interior of the cottage was essentially one big room, divided into living areas by the use of brightly dyed cloth panels that swayed with the eddy of moving air from the open door. A vibrant green panel separated the living room from the kitchen. An electric blue shielded most of a brass bed frame from view. The windows were draped in the bolt ends of purple cotton twisted across brass hooks. I'd seen the same idea in a women's magazine in the dentist's office, but had never seen it used to such effect. The furniture was a mismatched collection of wicker and cast-offs, swathes of navy and purple cotton, distinguishing the worn arms, lending continuity to the look of the place. The effect was striking and seemed to suggest boldness and confidence. I realized, belatedly, that I hadn't come up with a cover story. Happily, I'm an old hand at lying, and I could feel one bubble up. "Sorry to disturb you," I said. "I'm, looking for an apartment in the area, and someone said you might be giving notice." Her look was cautious, and her tone was blunt. "Who said?" "Gee, I don't remember. A neighbor, I guess. I've been knocking on doors for days, it feels like." "Why you want to live around here? It's depressing." "It's close to where I work," I said, praying she wouldn't ask where that was. I'd probably pretend to be a waitress, but I couldn't for the life of me remember any restaurants close by. She stared at me. "Actually, I'm hoping to move in a couple of weeks," she said. "I got some money coming in that I should hear about pretty soon." "That's great. Do you mind if I keep in touch?" She pulled her mouth down in a shrug. "Sure. I'd let you see the place, but it's kind of a mess. It's only one room, but it's fine if you're by yourself. You got furniture?" "Well, some. The landlord's pretty good about stuff like that. Most of this I'll leave when I move out. You'd need a bed." "I got that," I said. "You have a pen I could use? I'll make a note of your name and number and maybe give you a call in a couple of weeks." "Just a minute," she said. She closed the door, returning moments later with a scrap of paper and a pen. I looked at her expectantly. She tilted her head so she could watch me write. "Diaz, Bibiana, with two N's." "Thanks." I left Bibiana and went home, where I finally had a moment to examine the letter I'd stolen from Bibiana's mailbox. I made a note of the name and address of the recipient, a Gina Diaz in Culver City, California. Bibiana's mother or sister, by my guess. From my desk drawer, I pulled out an aerosol can of some chemical concoction that turns opaque paper translucent for 30 to 60 seconds. Spray it on an envelope, and you can read what's inside without going to the trouble of steaming it open. Clearly marked on the can, of course, is a stiffly worded warning, reminding the user that tampering with written communications, while in United States Postal Service channels, is punishable by up to 5 years in prison and or a $2,000 fine. God, I should really open up a little savings account, in case I get caught doing stuff like this. I depressed the nozzle and dampened the surface of the envelope with a fine mist, then held it up to the light. The note said, "Hi, Ma, I'm fine so far. Dollars should come through any time. Please don't let Raymond know you've heard from me. Love, B." I watched the envelope become opaque again without any visible mark, discoloration, or odor. I took it out to the street and tucked it in my mailbox for tomorrow's pickup. I returned to my apartment and put a quick call through to Mary Bellflower. I caught her just as she was getting ready to close up her desk for the day. Have you heard anything from ICPI?
Not really. I'm still waiting for a call back.
Keep me posted, I said.
Right.
I put on a pot of coffee and went up the spiral stairs to the loft. I changed clothes again, this time pulling on a black tank top, tight ankle-high black pants, short white socks with an edging of lace, and scuffed low-heeled black pumps. I ratted my hair, securing one hunk of it in a rubber band so that it stuck straight up like a little hair spout. I applied, inexpertly, I'll admit, eyeliner, mascara, blushers, and gaudy red lipstick, then clipped on big dangle earrings replete with red stones that no one in their right mind would mistake for rubies. Then I sprayed my entire upper body with cheap scent. I stared at myself in the bathroom mirror. I half turned away from the mirror and looked back, pulled one shoulder up and pursed my lips. What a vamp! What a tramp! I didn't know I had it in me. I clomped down my spiral stairs to the kitchenette and made myself an olive pimento cheese sandwich, which I packed in a metal lunchbox with an apple, some graham crackers, a thermos of hot coffee, and a Dick Francis paperback. I grabbed my black leather jacket, tucked the fake Hannah Moore ID in my pants pocket, and snagged my car keys. I drove back over to Bibiana's neighborhood and parked a few doors away. I got out of the car and hiked down to the mini-market to use the payphone. The meat counter was locked up, and the guy was stocking shelves. I didn't see Mom. I dropped in two dimes and dialed Bibiana's number. When she answered after two rings, I held my nose and asked for Maine. I sounded like a cold sufferer on a TV commercial for an antihistamine.
Who?
Babe.
You got a wrong number.
Sorry, I said. I returned to my car and settled in. From my position, I could see the mouth of the driveway, much of the big brown house, and a portion of the yard, but nothing of Bibiana's cottage, which was located in the rear. My assumption was that if she left the premises, she'd surface somewhere in front, and I could follow by car or on foot, whichever seemed more appropriate. I had no idea if she intended to go out or where she might go if she did, but she struck me as the restless type, and I was hoping she'd find some reason to stir, even if her purpose was no more important than a run to the corner market for a six-pack. I turned on the car radio just in time for the 5:30 news. The talk of rain was beginning to sound like something more than mere rumor. I stuck my head out the car window and stared upward. A ceiling of darkening clouds was creating the illusion of sudden twilight. The wind was picking up, blowing a dried palm frond along the street. Secretly, I wished I could go back to my place and lock myself in for the night, instead of spying on Bibiana Diaz. I switched from station to station, listening to a rotating selection of popular songs that all seemed to sound the same. I kept one eye on the driveway and one on my book, but the dark came so quickly I wasn't able to read much. The street lights popped on, and I could see that the tree leaves had taken on a patent leather sheen, a deep glossy green that seemed to shimmer in the darkness. At supper time, the neighborhood began to stir with life, people coming home from work, house lights coming on. A single-car surveillance is usually considered the least productive technique in any private investigator's little bag of tricks. In order to be discreet, you have to keep so much distance between yourself and the subject that visual contact is tough to maintain without being made. Then, too, if Bibiana was picked up by car, I had a 50-50 chance of being headed in the right direction. If I'd guessed wrong, I was sunk. A sudden U-turn in a residential neighborhood is a conspicuous move, and one almost guaranteed to alert the driver of the car you're following. With a two-car surveillance, you can at least trade off positions, and the subject is less likely to become suspicious. Unfortunately, I hadn't been authorized to hire outside help on this. For all I knew, Gordon Titus had fired me in absentia. It certainly seemed like the wrong time to ask for a cash advance. I was operating on the cheap, trying to establish a relationship with the woman so I could find out what she was up to. A well-documented claim file is fundamental to successful prosecution under theft by deception statutes. Before handing over the files to the Insurance Crime Prevention Institute, CF would want to provide proof of a material false representation, proof of intent to defraud, evidence that the claims adjuster relied upon representations by the claimant in paying the claim, and evidence of payment. If Bibiana was scamming Aetna and Allstate along with California Fidelity, it would probably mean hiring a handwriting expert to establish the links, though there might well be matching fingerprints on all the claim forms she'd sent. With fraud, as with most crimes, the perpetrator's job was a lot easier than ours. At 7:25, to relieve the boredom, I ate my sandwich and 2 graham crackers. It was now fully dark, and a pale mist filled the air, a rain so fine that it scarcely dampened the pavement. I turned the engine on twice, letting it run for brief periods until the car warmed up. A pizza was delivered to a nearby apartment complex. The passing scent of pepperoni and melted mozzarella nearly brought tears to my eyes. An old lady walked by in a robe and a shawl with her cocker spaniel on a leash. Cars passed, moving in both directions, but none slowed down, and there was no sign of Bibiana. By 9, I found myself slouched down on my spine, knees propped up against the steering wheel, trying to keep from nodding off. The couple from the CF offices had never made an appearance, and I was about to write them off. Either they had no idea where Bibiana Diaz now lived, or they had no compelling interest in her in the first place. I couldn't imagine why they'd gone to the trouble of tracking her down if they didn't mean to pursue the point. Maybe something had scared them off. Idly, I wondered if they were in a parked car nearby waiting for her themselves. At 9:45, quite suddenly, Bibiana appeared in the driveway. She was wearing red again, a body-hugging chemise that hit her mid-thigh, dark hose and red spike heels. For someone so petite, her legs looked incredibly long and shapely, giving an impression of height when she was probably barely 5'1". She had one hand tucked in the pocket of a cracked brown leather bomber jacket that she'd left unzipped. With the other hand, she held a section of newspaper above her head, shielding her hair from the drizzle. She had her face turned in my direction, scanning the street, but she didn't seem to register the fact that she was being observed. 5 minutes later, a yellow cab passed and came to a stop in front of her. She got in. I started my VW while she slammed the taxi door and settled herself in the back seat. I eased out into the street, flipping my headlights on as the taxi pulled away, hoping my appearance behind it would seem part of the natural flow of traffic in the area. We traveled sedately on surface streets, heading toward Cabana Boulevard, the wide avenue that parallels the beach. This was my turf, and I had to imagine she was heading toward the big restaurant bar out on the wharf, or perhaps to one of the bawdy bars at the lower end of State Street. It turned out to be the latter. The cab slowed in front of a low-life bar called the Meat Locker. The ABC had shut the place down twice in the past for serving alcohol to minors, and the previous owner had consequently lost his liquor license. The bar had been sold and was open now under new management. I drove on past. Through my rear-view mirror, I watched as Bibiana emerged from the cab, paid the driver, and headed toward the entrance. I hung a left, drove around the block, and returned to the parking lot, where I squeezed the VW into a quasi-legal parking spot against the wall. As I locked the car, ducking my head against the sprinkle of rain, I could feel the pavement vibrate with the music from the bar. I took my last breath of fresh air and walked into the place. Just inside the door, I paid the $5 cover charge and had the back of my hand stamped in purple with a USDA designation of Choice. The meat locker looked like it had been designed originally for industrial purposes and converted to commercial use without much concession to aesthetics. The room was cavernous and drab, with a concrete floor and metal beams showing high up in the shadowy reaches of the ceiling. A 19-foot bar ran along the wall to the right, packed 3 deep with guys whose faces looked like they belonged on the post office wall. The place smelled of beer and cigarette smoke, corn tortillas fried in lard, with an occasional whiff of dope wafting through the side door from the alleyway. All the house lights were blue. There was a live band, five guys who looked like junior high school thugs and sounded like they should still be practicing in someone's garage. The music was a raunchy blend of thumping bass, pulsing synthesizers, relentlessly repeated chords, and lyrics that were vile if you managed to discern the words above the piercing electronic howls. The dance floor was a portable wooden pallet, maybe 20 feet on a side, jammed with bouncing bodies, faces lathered in sweat. This was where the C-singles came to hunt. There were no yuppies, no preppies, no slumming execs, no middle-class white-bread college types. This was a hardcore pickup place for bikers and hamburger hookers who'd screw anyone for a meal. Bar fights and knifings were taken as a matter of course. Uniformed beat cops strolling through so often they were assumed to be customers. The noise level was intolerable, punctuated by an intermittent bam and bursts of raucous laughter. The bar was famous for a drink called a slammer. Tequila and 7-Up in an old-fashioned glass. When the drink was served, a cloth napkin was placed across the mouth of the glass, which was then slammed down on a wooden board the waitress carried. The blow forced the tequila and 7-Up together in a high-test infusion, which the patron was expected to toss down in one gulp. Usually the limit was 2 slammers per customer. After 2, most women had to be helped, toes dragging, to the car. After 3, men had the urge to break wooden chairs or bash a hand through glass. As I inched my way across the bar, I murmured, "Pardon me, excuse me," and "Oops, sorry," as I progressed, sensing an occasional anonymous hand on my ass. I found an unoccupied spot and claimed temporary ownership, leaning against the wall like everybody else. I ordered a beer from a passing barmaid who was decked out in an orange day-glow leotard that was cut straight up her crack in the rear. Her buns were hanging out like water-filled balloons. There was no place to sit, so I stood where I was, wedged in against a beam while I surveyed the crowd. I spotted Bibiana on the dance floor, undulating with remarkable energy and grace to some grinding sex tune. Men's eyes seemed to follow every shimmy, every bump. The blue lights reacted with the olive tones of her skin to create an unearthly radiance that emphasized the smooth oval of her face above the bulging breasts in the low-cut chemise. The dress seemed to glow more purple than red, pulled taut across the flat belly, slim hips, and trim thighs. When the music ended, she gave her dark hair a toss and moved away from the dance floor without a backward glance. Her partner, visibly winded, looked after her with admiration. She began to make the rounds. She was apparently well known, pausing to exchange laughing comments with a number of guys. I made myself conspicuous, pretending to be oblivious when, by my calculations, her path would soon be intersecting mine. Foiled. Before she reached me, she changed directions, and I could see her inching toward the short corridor where the restrooms were located. I headed in that direction, risking rude remarks as I pushed my way through. By the time I reached the ladies' room, she had entered one of the stalls. I stood at the mirror, fussing with my topknot, until the toilet flushed and Bibiana emerged. She moved to the sink beside mine, glancing at me idly in the mirror. I sensed, more than saw, the little jolt of recognition. She said, "Hey." I gave her a blank look. "Didn't you stop by this afternoon to ask about my place?" I looked over at her politely, and then allowed myself the same double take. "Oh, hi! I didn't realize it was you. What a coincidence. That's amazing. How are you?" "I'm fine. How'd the house hunting go? Did you find anything?" I made a face. "Not really. I got a line on an apartment about a block away from yours, but it isn't half as nice." Bibiana took out her lipstick. She applied an arc of red to her lower lip, rubbing it against the upper lip until the color had spread uniformly across her mouth. I made a few little gestures of my own, imitating hers. She capped the lipstick. "You ever been here before?" I shrugged. "Couple of times. Before this new management. It's kind of unnerving, isn't it? I don't appreciate guys grabbing my butt every time I make a move." She studied me briefly.
Depends on what you're used to, I guess. Doesn't bother me.
She turned her attention from my reflection to hers, leaning forward to adjust the wisps of hair around her face. She checked her eye makeup for flaws, staring at herself gravely before she glanced back at me.
I hope you don't mind my saying this, but that hair and the get-up are completely wrong.
They are?
I looked down at myself, a feeling of despair washing over me. What is it about me that invites this kind of comment? Here I think of myself as a kick-ass private eye, when other people apparently see me as a waif in need of mothering.
Mind if I make a suggestion? She asked.
Fine with me, I said.
The next thing I knew, she'd whipped the rubber band out of my hair. She reached in her purse and took out some kind of bottled hair snot, which she rubbed between her palms and then massaged through my hair. I felt like a dog being groomed, but I liked the effect. My tresses looked faintly wet now, with just the suggestion of curl. The two of us checked my reflection in the mirror. Bibiana's mouth pulled down judiciously.
Better, she said. You got a scarf on you anywhere?
I shook my head.
Let me see what I got.
She began to root around in her handbag, pulling out a joint in the process.
You want a smoke?
She asked idly. I shook my head.
I already toked up out in the parking lot before I came in.
She tucked the dope away without further comment, intent on her search through the various compartments of her voluminous bag.
Here we go. How's this?
She pulled up a square of lime-green silk and then made a face.
No good. Color's not right for you.
Dump the earrings. That'll help.
How do women know these things?
More important, how come I don't?
I removed the gaudy baubles from my ears and massaged my lobes with relief.
Meanwhile, she'd managed to unearth a second scarf, this one hot pink. She held it near my face, squinting at it critically. I thought she was going to make me dampen it with spit so she could wash my face. But she did some kind of tricky fold and tied the thing around my neck. Immediately, my color seemed to improve.
That looks great. Now what?
You come on with me. I'll keep the worst of these shitheads away from you.
Chapter 6. I followed her into the crowd like a rookie soldier into battle. Male eyes surveyed us from head to toe, grading us according to the size of our tits, how much butt we had hanging out, and how available we seemed. Bibiana netted a lot of mouth noises, a hand gesture, and some disgusting propositions which she seemed to find amusing, tossing casual insults at the guys most vocal in their appreciation. She was easygoing, good-natured, with a quick, infectious laugh. The music started up again, and she began to dance as she walked, snapping her fingers, working her way through the crowd with an occasional crotch-activating bump and grind. She was scanning faces, and I wondered who she was looking for. It didn't take long to find out. Her animation kicked up a notch, like the sudden surge in electric current preceding a blackout. Her body seemed to suffuse with a palpable heat.
"Stick around," she said. "I'll be back."
A blonde guy separated himself from the pack of studs at the bar. He was curly-haired with wire-rimmed glasses, a mustache, strong chin, a slight smile turning up the corners of his mouth. I found myself making note of his physical characteristics like a beat cop on patrol at the sight of a suspect. I knew the guy. He was of medium height, broad shoulders, narrow hips, dressed in jeans and a tight-fitting black polo shirt with short sleeves pushed up by well-developed biceps. Tate. Crazy Jimmy. How many years had it been since I'd seen him? He looked at Bibiana possessively, his thumbs tucked into his belt loop so that his hands seemed to bracket the bulge in the front of his pants. His manner was tempered with self-mocking, an irresistible blend of humor and awareness. I watched as he moved in her direction, already engaging her in some kind of wordless foreplay. No one else seemed to be aware of them. They approached the dance floor from adjacent sides, meeting somewhere in the middle as if every move were choreographed. This was mating behavior. A table opened up, and I snagged one of the empty chairs, putting my jacket across the back of the chair beside me to ward off any poachers.
By the time I looked back at the dance floor, I'd lost sight of Bibiana, but I caught a flash of her red dress in the pulsating mass of dancers and occasional glimpses of her partner's face. I had known him in another context altogether, and I couldn't quite reconcile the incongruity of my past perception of him with the setting in which I now saw him. His hair had been shorter then, and the mustache was new. But the aura was the same. Jimmy Tate was a cop. Probably an ex-cop by now, if the rumors were correct. Our paths had crossed the first time in elementary school, fifth grade, where for half a year we were soulmates, bound by a pact we'd sealed by touching tongues. Solemn stuff. Jimmy was into what they call acting out. I'm not sure what had happened to his parents, but he'd lived in foster homes all his life, getting kicked out of first one, then another. He was a kid who'd been labeled incorrigible by the age of eight, rebellious, prone to fistfights and bloody noses. He was frequently truant, and since I was given to truancy myself back then, we formed an odd bond. In many ways, I was a timid child, but I had a wild streak of my own, born of grief at the loss of my parents when I was five. My mutiny originated in fear, Jimmy's in rage, but the net result was the same. I could see that under his defiance, there was such pain and such sweetness. I may even have loved him in my own innocent, prepubescent way. He was 12 years old to my 11 when I met him, a bewildered boy who had no concept of self-control. More than once he came to my defense, beating the snot out of some bullying fifth-grade boy who'd tried pushing me around. I could still recall the exhilaration I felt every time we raced away from the schoolyard, giddy with freedom, knowing how short-lived our liberation would be. He introduced me to cigarettes, tried getting me high on aspirin and coke, showed me the difference between boys and girls. I can still remember the mix of mirth and pity I felt when I realized all boys were afflicted with a doodad that looked like an ill-placed thumb stuck between their legs. Eventually, Jimmy's foster mother declared him out of control and sent him back to wherever it was unwanted kids were sent in those days. Juvenile hall, I guess. I didn't see him for 8 years, and then I was astonished when he showed up my first day at the police academy. By then, his toughness had a manic edge. He was a pretty boy and a boozer, out until all hours. How he got accepted into the academy, I'll never know. Candidates are put through rigorous psychological evaluation, at which point the unsuitable and the unstable are quickly eliminated. He must have eluded the wily probing of his examiners. Or maybe he was one of those rare individuals whose personality flaws don't show up under scrutiny. His academy grades were usually borderline, but he never missed a class, and his competitive nature kept him in the game. He was savvy enough to turn the heat down when he had to, but he never kept himself in check for long. He did manage to graduate with the rest of us, but he was always skirting disaster in some form. I'd kept my distance, too invested in my own career at that point to risk the taint of his reputation. He'd applied for a job with the Santa Teresa Police Department at the same time I did, but he'd been turned down. I lost track of him for a while, and then I heard he'd joined the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. Word of his exploits started leaking back to us. In bars after hours, the talk would start, cops trading tales about the crazy things Jimmy Tate had done. He was the kind of officer you wanted next to you any time there was trouble. In a pinch, he was absolutely fearless, oblivious of danger. In a pissing contest with the bad guys, he was right out in front. His aggression seemed to generate a force field around him, a protective shield. Other cops had told me that watching him under fire, you became aware that in his own way he was as dangerous as they were. The bank robbers, the dopers, gang members, snipers, all the lunatics who had it in for us law and order types. Unfortunately, his ferocity pushed him across the line more than once. I gathered he did things you didn't talk about later, things you pretended you hadn't seen because he'd saved your life and you owed him. Eventually, he was tapped as part of a special investigating unit put together to monitor the activities of known criminals. 6 months later, the section was disbanded after a series of questionable shootings. 12 officers were suspended, Jimmy Tate among them. All were reinstated after review by the police commission, but it seemed clear it was only a matter of time before something blew in a big way. 2 years ago, I'd come across his name in the L.A. Times. He'd been assigned to a narcotics unit and had just been indicted along with 6 other deputies in a money-skimming scandal that was rocking the department. The details were spelled out day after day during preliminary hearings. 5 of the 6 were bound over for trial, and one of those blew his brains out. I followed the court proceedings and occasional copies of the L.A. Times, though I never heard the outcome. It wouldn't have surprised me to learn he was guilty as charged. He was reckless and self-destructive. But as odd as it sounds, I knew if I'd had a brother, I'd have wanted him to be exactly like Jimmy Tate. Not for his conduct and the dubious underlying morality, but because of his loyalty and his passionate commitment to survival. We live in a society piously concerned about the rights of criminals when their victims' lives have been trashed without any consideration of the price in pain and suffering. With Jimmy Tate in charge, believe me, justice was served. There simply wasn't much attention paid to the technicalities involved. He and Bibiana came off the dance floor. The band was taking a break, and the noise level dropped so fast it was almost like turning deaf. I focused on Jimmy's face, knowing any minute he'd spot me and the recognition would leap in his eyes. The two of them sat down at the table, and Bibiana pulled her hair up with one hand and fanned her bare neck with the other. She was winded, laughing, the color high in her cheeks, her hair damp at the temples where the dark strands had separated into little tendrils. "This is the woman I was telling you about, who came to look at my place," she said to him, indicating me. "What did you say your name was?" Jimmy's smile was polite as his gaze traveled from her face to mine. I held a hand out. "Hello, Jimmy. I'm Hannah Moore," I said. "You remember me?" Clearly he did, and I knew from his look my real name was attached to the recollection. Whatever his current status, he was still too thoroughly trained as a cop to blow my cover. He smiled as he took my hand, dosing me with the same low-voltage sexuality he'd turned on Bibiana. He lifted my hand to his mouth, kissing my knuckle affectionately. "God, babe, how are you? It's been years," he said. "You two know each other?" she asked. He returned my hand to me reluctantly. "We were in grade school together," he said without pause, and I felt myself flush with pleasure since that was the connection I cared about. The academy and whatever happened after that was the stuff of our grown-up years. The other had a magical quality that would always take precedence in my book. He pulled a crumpled bill out of his pants pocket with a glance at Bibiana before his eyes returned to my face. "I need some cigarettes, doll. Can you do me that?" She hesitated just long enough to let him know her cooperation was a gift. Her smile was underlined with irony, and the look she gave me was knowing. She tucked the bill between her breasts and walked away without a word. Jimmy's gaze traced a loving line up her legs to her hips. She was moving with the self-conscious thrust and sway of a model or a starlet, aware of her effect. She sent a slow smile back to him, puckering her mouth in a gesture that was half pout, half promise. I felt a laugh bubble up. "I can't believe running into you this way," I said. "How do you know Bibiana?" He smiled. "I met her in L.A. at a Halloween party a year ago. I saw her a couple of times down there, then ran into her again up here."
"I had no idea you were back. What have you been up to?"
"Not much," he said. His eyes flicked across my face as he checked me out. "How about yourself? Last I heard, you'd left the department and were working for some agency."
"I was. I got licensed. Now I work for myself. Are you still with the L.A. County Sheriff's?"
"Not exactly."
"What exactly are you doing? Last I heard, you were being tried for theft," I said.
"She's something, isn't she?" he said, avoiding my question.
"What's the story, Jimmy?"
He propped his chin on his fist, smiling at me with his eyes. "I'm retired. I sued the shit out of them. $10 million."
"You sued them?" I said. "What about the charges?"
My reaction seemed to amuse him, and I watched him shrug. "I was acquitted. That's the way the system works. Sometimes you get the bear, sometimes the bear gets you. I'd been on medical leave, collecting disability for job-related pain and stress. Next thing I know, there's a bunch of us charged with conspiracy, money laundering, income tax evasion, God knows what else. They put us through hell, and by the time I got from under that, all my benefits were cut and I was being asked to resign. Forget that. No way. I found a lawyer and filed suit.
After you were cleared?
Shit, yes. I'm not going to let them get away with that. The way they see it, I got off on a technicality. I was the only one acquitted, but I still did the whole 9 yards the same as the others. So why am I being penalized twice? A jury said I was innocent. Were you? Of course not, but that's not the point, he said. The prosecution had a shot at me and couldn't make it stick, so now I'm off the hook. Doesn't matter if I did it or not. Court says I'm clear, I'm clear. That's the law.
So they fired you?
In effect. What they did was they axed my disability. They decided I was trouble and they wanted me out of there, which is why they cut my benefits. Said I had an attitude. No way I was going to put up with that, so I sued their asses off. We just settled last week. $750,000. Of course, when the check comes through, my attorney's going to take his cut off the top, but I'm still going to end up with $365,000. My retirement fund. Pretty good, yes?
That's great.
Meantime, I'm flat broke, but what are you going to do?
What about Bibiana? Does she know you're a cop?
Does she know you're a PI?
I shook my head to one side, his smile fading as he saw my expression shift.
You're not investigating her.
I didn't answer, which was answer enough.
What for? He asked.
I figured I might as well level with him. He'd find a way to get it out of me eventually.
Insurance fraud, I said, watching for his reaction.
If I'd hoped to surprise him, I was out of luck.
Who are you working for?
California Fidelity.
Can you make a case?
Probably, by the time I'm done at any rate, I said. He looked away from me then, eyes straying toward the jukebox. I followed the line of his gaze, catching sight of Bibiana. A rainbow of lights played across her face. There was something about her, a dusky beauty, a physical perfection that must have been irresistible, judging by the way he watched her. I saw her throw her head back and laugh, though the sound didn't carry. She was flirting with the drummer, one hand resting lightly on his arm in a gesture both intimate and casual. The drummer was tall and skinny, with a face like a collie, his eyes close together and glittering with chemical substances the human body doesn't manufacture naturally. He was staring at her breasts, probably emitting the high-pitched, hopeful whine of a pup hoping for a milk bone. She wasn't looking at us, but every phrase in her body language conveyed her awareness of Jimmy. Tit for tat, as it were. She turned to the jukebox and dropped in some coins,